Today I'm joined once again by Marcia Reed, the managing editor of geopoliticalmonitor.com, for our monthly update of geopolitical news from around the world. Marcia Reed, thank you very much for joining me on the program once again.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Marcia, can you get into the topics that we're going to be covering today?
Sure. There are a number of topics that I think are of interest. The first is the situation in Iraq regarding the status of forces agreement. The second would be Afghanistan and the new U.S. strategy. A third issue would be Russia. And the fourth would be the election of Barack Obama as the U.S. president.
All right. Well, let's get straight into it. What can you tell us about the latest updates to the status of forces agreement in Iraq?
Well, the status of forces agreement, first of all, it provides a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Iraq, and it details the nature of the U.S. occupation with regards to the conduct of U.S. troops while in Iraq. And for the Iraqis, this has been a very contentious issue because they have been continually negotiating with the United States over issues such as the legal jurisdiction of Iraqi law over U.S. personnel, meaning that U.S. troops would be subject to Iraqi law if they commit any crimes or off base, as well as committing crimes outside of combat zone. And also another new issue would be dealing with the U.S. not committing any airstrikes or any incursions into neighboring countries. And this comes about because of the recent developments with the U.S. conducting an airstrike in Syria. What the Iraqis have been trying to do is get the United States to agree to these amendments, which would be mainly the U.S. Personnel coming under Iraqi law, and the promise that the United States will not commit any incursions or violate the sovereignty of their neighbors. As I'm sure your listeners might know previously, or if not, I'll update them or let them know, that neighboring countries, Iraq's neighbors, have been concerned about this agreement, and there were concern that a U.S. presence or permanent military presence would be destabilizing to the region, that this sort of occupation would become permanent, just like in Korea, in South Korea, with troops being stationed there since the 1950s. So countries like Syria and Iran have been very concerned about a permanent U.S. presence. And the idea that U.S. military bases in Iraq would be a launching pad for attacks into those countries. The United States has said, you know, that they're not going to continue to amend this pact, that they've done all that they can, that they've agreed to a deadline of 2011, that they've agreed to the terms of the pact, and to cede anymore would just be ridiculous. But Iraq has requested this. The United States has yet to respond, although there's like mixed reactions. People are saying it's been viewed favorably by Washington, while others say that it's actually not been the case, that they're really hard-pressed to agree to the request of the Iraqis. The other problem is that with an election coming up in January, the Iraqis will not find it politically expedient to agree to this status of forces agreement, meaning that they will probably vote against it no matter what the United States agrees to, because the fact that the Iraqi population is pretty tired of a U.S. occupation and would like to see the U.S. military presence end by the end of this UN mandate, which expires in December 31st. So it seems like it's not really going well either way with this agreement.
So clarify that for the listeners a little bit more. What is the difference between the actual status of forces agreement and the UN mandate that legalizes the American presence in Iraq?
Well, the UN mandate is a mandate allowing the U.S. occupation until the end of December 31st of this year. But the U.S. forces would not fall under Iraqi law, and there would be no agreements between the U.S. and the Iraqi government regarding any activities that the U.S. military decides to undertake within Iraq or in the neighboring region. So the United States would not have to consult Iraq on any of its initiatives dealing with the insurgency or any activity. It would sort of have a kind of carte blanche, so to speak. Whereas with the status of force agreement, there are direct, clear lines drawn in terms of what U.S. personnel can and cannot do. The big issue is U.S. personnel falling under the jurisdiction of Iraqi law. So if a U.S. soldier commits a crime while off base and off duty, they would be tried by an Iraqi court. As well, the fact that the U.S. would have to promise not to commit any attacks on neighboring countries is another issue. So this really is sort of cramping the U.S. military style. I mean, they really don't, they're really not able to just do as they please. And so the Syrian airstrike seems to really underscore this fact that the United States, or at least lend credence to concerns of neighboring countries like Iran and Syria, that U.S. presence would destabilize the region and be obviously detrimental to these countries. We've seen the U.S. ostensibly claim that they were trying to stop Al-Qaeda and Iraq operatives by going into Syria, yet at the same time, you can say that this airstrike in Syria was to keep Syria in check since their influence in the region is growing. Likewise, they could do the same in Iran by launching an attack from Iraq. So what's to say that they're not going to just continue with these incursions without any regard to the ramifications in the region? So this is the big issue, is just the status of force agreement really places limits on what U.S. troops, U.S. and what U.S. personnel can and cannot do in the area.
Very interesting. Well, I'm not sure if you've caught it, but yesterday in the New York Times, a major story came out under the headline, Secret Order Lets U.S. Raid Al-Qaeda in Many Countries. And the first paragraph reads, the United States military since 2004 has used broad secret authority to carry out nearly a dozen previously undisclosed attacks against Al-Qaeda and other militants in Syria, Pakistan, and elsewhere, according to senior American officials. And the story goes on to detail the fact that there has been a secret program that was signed off on under Defense Secretary Rumsfeld back in 2004 that allowed or that authorized the U.S. military to operate with the CIA in various strikes against Al-Qaeda targets in different nations, which, of course, throws a bit of a monkey wrench into the works when it comes to things like launching attacks from Iraq into Syria and things of that nature. Although I suppose the Status of Forces Agreement would override any such military orders done internally in the United States. But this type of story probably won't help the U.S. negotiation stance in the Security Pact with Iraq, I suppose.
Exactly. I actually read that article as well just a few hours ago, and I found it quite interesting that that was the case. But I think that if a president chose to issue executive orders and to use special operations forces, they could still get around this status of forces agreement. I don't think anything would really stop, well, at least in the Bush administration, would stop them from doing what they want to, as we've seen with Pakistan as well. So it's quite interesting to see what's been happening with the kind of carte blanche given to special ops and the CIA in its war on terror. So that is an interesting development. But I mean, regarding the Status of Forces Agreement, I think that, like I mentioned earlier, it's sort of dead in the water. It's just not politically expedient for Iraqi politicians to go through with it. They have elections coming up in January. And they're going to say no to it, even though they do realize that they, for them, the necessity of having U.S. troops at the moment and their inability to necessarily deal with insurgency or the violence that's still going on in Iraq. So it's a really tough situation for the Iraqi electorates. So it's just a matter of waiting to see what the U.S. officially says in the coming days regarding the latest demands that the Iraqis have made.
So assuming that an agreement is not reached, how do you foresee this playing out, not just in the coming weeks or months, but possibly longer term in Iraq?
Well, if it isn't reached, I think what's going to happen is that the U.S. is definitely going to go to the U.N. Security Council and have a new mandate put in place, something they definitely don't want to do. But I really can't see the U.S. allowing a situation like this to occur where there wouldn't be some kind of responsible, or at least as they say, responsible or timely withdrawal. So even if this doesn't go through, they're going to go through the UN allow another mandate. It would just remain to be seen how long that new mandate would last, because there's the fear that the Russians may veto having a new mandate for the sake of just, which I might, we'll talk about later, just flexing their muscles politically against the U.S. And the U.S. would have to give into a number of concessions to allow the Russians to not veto a new mandate. So I think what would happen would be a situation where the U.S. would definitely not allow it to get to that worst case scenario where there isn't a legal presence of U.S. troops, and that there would be a more timely and organized withdrawal. Now, if the worst case scenario does happen and there are no U.S. troops, what you would see would be an opportunity for Iran to reassert itself in terms of influence in the country through proxies, through the Shia militia or politicians. So that would be a situation that would also not be in the U.S.'s best interest. They've definitely been trying to prohibit Iran's influence in the region, and this is something that would probably happen if the U.S. Withdrew by the end of December. It's something that would probably happen when the U.S. withdraw in the next 3 years, is Iran's going to try and find a way to get its foot in the door and have more influence in Iraq. But it's something the U.S. is trying to sort of stave off for as long as possible. So either way, it's a really bad situation in Iraq, and you're just hoping for the best. You're hoping that you're going to have a government that is more pro-U.S. than pro-Iranian, and a situation where their forces are able to deal with any of the insurgents and any violence in Iraq, and keeping that violence at the lowest levels possible. I don't know if they're going to be able to completely have a stable Iraq anytime soon, but you know, you're just hoping at this point, you're hoping just to keep it to an acceptably low level. So I think that's what you could see happen if the status of force agreement doesn't go through and the UN mandate doesn't occur as the U.S. would like it to, if they have to go through a mandate again.
All right. Very interesting. And are there any other aspects of this story you wanted to cover before we move on?
Nothing else really, except just to keep in mind the fact that Iraq is sort of central in terms of U.S. Influence in the region. I mean, when you have Iran and Syria as these neighboring countries that are able to or are attempting to exert influence in the region, the United States has a lot at stake. So it's very important for them, maybe more so than the Iraqis, that they have this agreement go through, especially before the end of Bush's term, before he leaves office in January. I think the biggest concern is that if it doesn't go through now, then this will be an opportunity for the Obama administration to create terms for a quicker withdrawal. So this is definitely a very important issue at the moment for the U.S. with regards to their policy in Iraq, and definitely trying to keep a pro-U.S. Government in the area, in the region.
All right, a very important issue, and one that we'll have to keep our eyes on. All right, what would you like to cover next?
Well, with Afghanistan, we have quite interesting developments with regards to the U.S. taking on a new strategy, which is diplomacy with the Taliban. Previously, this would have been unheard of or unfathomable even a year ago to think about U.S. Senior generals and even NATO generals talking about diplomacy. But it's something that's finally come up, and I think this is a huge development that the United States is finally officially beginning to realize what many people have been saying for a long time, is that a military victory in Afghanistan is not feasible. The Russians learned that the hard way over almost a decade of fighting the Afghans in the 1980s, 1979 until I believe late 1980s. So I think the Americans are finally beginning to realize this as well. And they finally realized that in order to succeed in Afghanistan, negotiations are the only way.
So what was the ostensible reason given for this sudden shift in strategy, and who are the main negotiators at the table at the moment?
Well, the shift in the strategy can be credited to the resurgence of the Taliban. After 9/11, when the United States agreed to go into Taliban, and they had a coalition and NATO troops going in as well a bit later, They were able to rout the Taliban quite quickly. However, the Taliban has begun to regroup and has exerted itself and has caused a lot of casualties towards U.S. and NATO troops. So I think at the time, it was especially when the United States agreed to go into Iraq in 2003, Afghanistan was overshadowed and largely forgotten. It was one of those sort of forgotten wars, I guess. And everyone was focusing on Iraq and Saddam Hussein and the power vacuum that was left by his death. And then suddenly around 2006 or 7, you started to hear about more troop casualties, and especially because of the sanctuary that the northwestern provinces of Pakistan have provided for these fighters. It's become increasingly worse. And you have the issue with NATO troops in terms of the European members of the NATO troops not being able to commit any more troops to the fighting in the region. And also they have these national caveats, which really place the brunt of the fighting on other members in the NATO forces as well. So, for example, when I say national caveats, I mean countries that place limits on what their troops can do in combat. Countries like France, Spain, Italy, or Germany would say, for example, restrict troops to certain areas, or they would not be able to fight under certain conditions, or they would only be able to engage in nation building by just dealing with civilian works like building roads and so on and so forth. So that leaves countries like the United States, Canada, the Netherlands, taking on the brunt of the fighting and a lot of the casualties. And this creates a lot of tension and animosity among the alliance, because there doesn't seem to be this cohesiveness and strategy, and in terms of everyone taking on an equal share of the fight. And so you have this situation where there seems to be a lot of what people have said, a lot of political wavering with Afghanistan. A lot of countries are seeing that it's not feasible and they don't want to commit any more troops. And you have the global financial crisis really limiting the amount of spending that countries can do towards this issue in Afghanistan. I mean, this was originally supposed to be a nation building exercise after outing the Taliban, but now it's continually fighting the Taliban. And so along with these increase in deaths of NATO troops and U.S. troops, as well as a lack of consensus on strategy, you now see a lot of top senior generals like General Petraeus, and also amongst the British, Brigadier Mark Carleton Smith, saying that victory in the traditional sense, meaning absolute military victory, is not possible. And even Secretary Robert Gates was saying that, you know, maybe we should consider negotiations with the Taliban, that this is something that is acceptable, and this doesn't mean defeat. This just means a reasonable end to this situation in this country. It can't continue like this indefinitely, and we need to have a coherent exit strategy. So negotiations and diplomacy with the Taliban would be one of them. This would sort of mirror what happened in Iraq with Petraeus getting a lot of the Sunnis to turning them to fight against jihadists. So this would be something similar, where they would negotiate with the Taliban to sort of sever all ties with al-Qaeda and work towards building the country and including the Taliban in this future government and the security of the country. So it's definitely been a kind of a huge about face in terms of where the U.S. and NATO was in terms of their strategy beginning in 2001 to 2003 and where they are now. So it's something that's going to be, I think it's going to be very interesting in the next few weeks and months, these developments in Afghanistan. As well, we also have the fact that there's going to be more troops committed to the region. And so definitely there's still the issue of militarily dealing with the insurgents, the fighting aspects of the Taliban that don't support the idea of U.S. or NATO troops in their country. So you still have to deal with militarily at least getting some kind of victory, but at the same time, negotiations would be preferable at this point. So I think it's very, very interesting development, something I couldn't imagine hearing from the Bush administration that they'd negotiate with the Taliban. So it's something people should definitely be aware of and keep in mind.
Well, this change in strategy certainly is in its nascent stages at the moment, but is there any indication at this time as to what form the goals and the restrictions that NATO would be seeking from such negotiations would be at this point?
Well, at this point, as you mentioned, it's really in the early stages, and I haven't heard much about what NATO has exactly requested from the Taliban, because a lot of the talks they've been backed by the UK, but they've been mediated through Saudi Arabia as well as Pakistan. And it would involve the Taliban, at least, would say they would provide a safe exit for NATO and US troops. They just simply don't want any more US or NATO troops in their country. That's just an absolute for them. They have to leave. So they would provide a safe exit for these troops. They definitely want to have control of key ministries in this new government that would be formed, and have more of a say in the process of, the government's process of policymaking. So this is something where the Taliban is amenable to this idea of negotiating, but it's on the grounds of just no more troops in the region at all, which goes against what President-elect Obama has decided, and is that, like Bush, he wants to commit more troops to Afghanistan. And NATO, a few NATO members are wavering as to whether or not to commit more troops or cut troops because, as I mentioned, the global financial crisis. But this is something the Taliban just won't tolerate, is having an increase in troops, or let alone any troops. So, and also, as I mentioned, control of key ministries in the government. Other than that, I don't know what else NATO would be able to say at this point, since this is just really just getting off the ground. General Petraeus, he visited Afghanistan early in this week, around November 3rd or 4th, just to get an assessment of what was happening in Afghanistan. So until he said any more, it's really hard to say what NATO and the U.S. are going to say or do in response to this new direction. But it's still the early days yet regarding this new change in strategy. So that's something I think maybe by next month we'll have a clearer idea of what NATO and what the U.S. Exactly will do, or how they'll respond to a Taliban.
Well, it certainly will be interesting to see how this develops, but we've noted in previous talks in our monthly update with geopoliticalmonitor.com about the increase in intensity of U.S. incursion into Pakistan in recent months, and I'm wondering whether we can expect to see that abating because of the about-face in strategy here, or could we see the fist of military incursion being wielded as another bargaining chip on the table in this negotiation process?
Right, yes. I don't think that just because the U.S. And NATO has talked about diplomacy, I don't think that means it's going to necessarily change what's happening on the ground right now. I think that, in fact, we've seen an increase in airstrikes from Afghanistan into Pakistan. I think it's been, scores of airstrikes since the U.S. has been conducting airstrikes into Pakistan. It's to the point now that the Pakistani government has strongly condemned these U.S. actions on their region. And General Petraeus had to speak with Pakistani officials and sort of explain why this is happening. And it's something I do not see ceasing at all. And I mean, the Bush administration, they're leaving in the next two and a half months. Even though Bush is a lame duck president, that's not going to stop him from pushing for more airstrikes, despite the fact that, Robert Gates and Petraeus have said, we want to deal with the Taliban through diplomacy. President Bush, I think, is really determined to leave his mark or have a legacy of some sort and sort of vindicate himself by having a clear foreseeable success through these airstrikes and somehow, getting bin Laden, So I think this is not going to mean an end to airstrikes. I think they're going to at least increase in the next few months as President Bush tries to, as I've said, vindicate himself and show that there was a rationale for this war on terror. He needs to have some kind of a tangible success. So definitely this is going to be continued. Obviously, there's going to be repercussions by continuing with these unilateral airstrikes. You're going to definitely antagonize people in Pakistan, and the Pakistan government doesn't like it at all either. It just creates this, as they've said, a gap in credibility when they're not able to stand up to the United States or have their sovereignty protected or, enforced. They look like an ineffectual and weak government, which they are in many ways. So it's just really bad for at least, the Pakistani people and the government and the military as well doesn't appreciate these unilateral airstrikes. The U.S. has, rationalized this because of the fact that these northwestern provinces provide sanctuary for the Taliban. But at the same time, they have to realize that in a lot of ways that they're creating or at least making the problem a lot worse than they are making it better. So having said that, I think it's still going to be a lot of the same before we sort of see any negotiations, if they do actually happen, because, people can say something and not follow through with it. So it still remains to be seen if this will actually come to something, some kind of fruitful conclusion of some sort. I definitely think these airstrikes from Afghanistan into Pakistan will continue as long as there are going to be casualties and fatalities amongst U.S. and NATO troops.
I certainly agree with that assessment, and I'm wondering about a possible Obama presidency. Would you see the airstrikes, the unilateral airstrikes in Pakistan ceasing in an Obama presidency, given that Obama was in fact one of the first major political figures to start advocating the unilateral bombing of Pakistan back in August of last year?
Yeah, that's another really interesting thing about the Obama administration is that everyone was really excited and happy about him being elected as the 44th president of the United States for obvious historical reasons, being the first African-American president, and as well as his political platform of change. So, the majority of the world, they heaved a collective sigh of relief at Obama being elected. However, I think people are conflating his desire for change in terms of domestic policy with change in foreign policy. I think that a lot will remain the same, at least within the Middle East, with an Obama administration. And so I think a lot of people in the international community will end up being disappointed in a lot of ways. Because Obama will definitely change a lot domestically with the U.S., with the financial crisis and his a platform of no taxes for the middle class and so on and so forth. But in terms of foreign policy, he's actually sort of been in agreement with President Bush. He definitely wants a withdrawal from Iraq like Bush has agreed to, except he wants it quicker. In Afghanistan, he wants to increase troops, just like President Bush does as well, and airstrikes in Pakistan. So there really isn't much that's different between Bush and Obama in terms of their foreign policy. I think maybe Obama might be more amenable to using diplomacy than Bush was. But I think in terms of the spirit of that policy is going to remain the same. And so this is something where I think the international community may think they've been deceived, but I think it's just a matter of the way they've perceived how Obama has spoken about the U.S. foreign policy. He's definitely talked about a multilateral approach. He'd been willing to listen to his allies, but that doesn't mean you're going to do what they've said or follow their suggestions. One can still listen without actually going through with what they've listened to. But at least for the Middle East and for South Asia, Obama is sort of eerie, but he's a mirror of President Bush. So I don't really see that there's going to be any change in terms of his strategy. I think airstrikes will continue in Pakistan as long as Pakistan remains unstable and chaotic, and as long as the northwestern tribal regions provide sanctuary for these Taliban fighters, it would not be in his interest at all to allow these fighters to inflict any more casualties on his troops. It would show a lack of support for the troops in the area, in the region, who are fighting Al-Qaeda and the Taliban. So I don't think just because he is more, I guess just because he decides he's going to use more diplomacy and listen to his allies and take a more multilateral approach with regards to certain issues, doesn't mean that he's going to change his policy or change the policy that President Bush has had in the Middle East and in South Asia with regards to Afghanistan, Pakistan, or India. So I think that's really something that's very interesting. And I think people have to be careful not to conflate domestic policy and foreign policy. He's talked about change domestically, but I don't really hear, or at least I didn't hear as much about change in terms of foreign policy for the large part. Maybe the strategy, or not the strategy, but the process might be a little bit different, but the end result is going to be the same.
All right. Well, let's use that as a segue point to talk a little bit more about the Obama election. What can you tell us about the broader geopolitical significance of this election?
Well, I think for in terms of outside or beyond the Middle East, you have as well Russia, which is a country that has been largely under the radar with the Bush administration. And that's something that the Obama administration will have to deal with. It just can't be ignored at this point, as we've seen from the Russian-Georgian war in August. I think what's going to happen is that despite the fact that the international community has been very enthusiastic about Obama's election, and like I said, they're going to quickly see that a lot will still remain the same. But Russia has sort of placed the ball in the Obama administration's court, because recently, just a day after Obama was elected, Russian President Medvedev, he made a speech similar to a State of the Union address that the U.S. president would give. He gave a State of the State address, and he talked about his vision for Russia and their foreign policy. And he had a lot of strong words for the United States. While he praised the election of Obama, he still said that that Russia has special interests in particular regions, meaning the former Soviet Union and elsewhere, that they are entitled to protect. And so Russia is not going to stop being Russia, at least in terms of what they've done recently with being a resurgent power. Medvedev does not believe in a unipolar system. He believes in a multipolar system, a country that can keep the United States in check. So, while he might agree with having friendly relations with countries and not wanting to isolate Russia from the rest of the international community, at the same time, he's going to protect Russian interests, and especially in the former Soviet bloc and elsewhere, probably Latin America with Venezuela and Cuba. So Russia is definitely on the rise. And that's something that the Obama administration will have to take into consideration, which means in order to do that, they're going to have to try and wrap things up in the Middle East. I don't know how possible it is to ever wrap things up in the Middle East with regards to foreign policy, but that will mean having to withdraw troops from Iraq, deal with Iran and their nuclear enrichment program, try and hammer out some kind of consensus with Afghanistan, and then have that military flexibility to deal with any other issues outside of the Middle East, meaning with Russia. I don't think Russia is going to want to start a war of any sort with the United States. I don't think anyone wants to see that. But there are definitely going to be other sort of flare-ups regarding Russia wielding more influence within Latin America. As I mentioned, Russia has a multi-billion dollar arms deal with Venezuela. Libya recently visited, Libya recently had an agreement with Russia regarding arms deals worth about $2 billion, and having Russian military base in Libya, which would provide Russia with a presence in the Mediterranean. You have Russia talking about forming a gas cartel with Iran and Qatar, and they have Russia establishing military bases in the future in Abkhazia and South Ossetia. The missile defense system, Russia deciding to place their own Iskander missiles along the EU border to mitigate the U.S. missile defense system. All of these are really big issues that, if not dealt with in the near future, will spiral and mushroom into larger issues. So for the Obama administration, it would be business as usual in the Middle East, but they'd have to deal with Russia. And Russia has already said, this is what we're about. These are our interests. It's up to you to deal with us how you see fit. You can accept what we've laid out on the table, and hopefully you'll do that. But if you don't, we're willing to deal with the consequences. Hopefully those consequences wouldn't be very dire. But I think that for the Russians, they're hoping that they can, manipulate, if not sway, an Obama administration to sort of see things their way. I think they think that Obama is a lot easier to deal with than Bush, since Obama seems to be, his personality, very likable, and he seems to be more open to diplomacy. And I think a lot of world leaders, like Russian President Dmitry Medvedev or Iran's Ahmadinejad, would think that it's easier to manipulate and deal with Obama than Bush, for whatever reasons. And so I think this is something that Obama has to be aware of as president in the next, you know, few months. Obviously, he still has to deal with domestic issues first in the next few months where he's president. But after that, in terms of foreign policy, definitely having to deal with Russia. So I think, yeah, that's one of the bigger geopolitical issues that he's going to have to deal with head on, something that President Bush wasn't able to do or deal with because of his lame duck presidency, which the Russians took advantage of. Now that Obama's been elected, they know who they're dealing with, and Obama's not going to be a lame duck. So Obama's going to have plenty of time to deal with Russia. So I think that's one of the bigger issues to sort of play itself out when Obama becomes president as well.
Well, I think you're absolutely right to locate the geopolitical significance of Obama's foreign policy in Russia, because I think that's obviously something that's been simmering in almost threatening to boil over in the Bush administration, but something that certainly could boil over at any point, given what we saw, for example, in Georgia recently. But I think it's obvious that U.S. imperialism is about to undergo a facelift and retreat under left cover, meaning that it will retreat under a guise of diplomacy and appearing to talk with allies, but in fact, actually just trying to form geostrategic alliances to better perhaps project U.S. power across the Eurasian area. And one factor in that, I guess, would be the fact that one of Obama's top foreign policy advisors was Zbigniew Brzezinski, who, of course, was the mastermind behind Operation Cyclone, which eventually drew the Soviet Union into Afghanistan back in 1979, one of Zbigniew Brzezinski's crowning achievements as national security advisor for Jimmy Carter, something that he bragged about to Le Nouvel Observateur back in 1998. So I think the Russian perspective would be a little bit wary of an Obama administration, especially given that Zbigniew Brzezinski is going to be apparently once again at the helm of Obama's foreign policy. Can you speak to the idea of a left cover for U.S. imperialism and perhaps things not going in the blatant, all-out aggressive stance of a Bush administration, but in a much more manipulative diplomatic way?
Right. I mean, it's interesting you bring up Brzezinski because, I mean, like you mentioned, he gave Russia their Vietnam with the Taliban. So, you could say that Russia would be wary of having an Obama administration, but McCain didn't seem, in terms of who's the lesser of two evils, and based on how people responded to McCain, I think a lot of people are under the perception that Obama is the lesser of two evils. However, as you've mentioned about a matter of a less blatant U.S. imperialism, this definitely doesn't mean the end of the U.S. empire, and that Obama doesn't necessarily mean a drastic change in U.S. foreign policy. I definitely think it's going to be, like you've mentioned exactly, just a geostrategic alliances. It's going to be business as usual, but it's just not going to be done so loudly or so blatantly. Obama has definitely decided to issue a number of executive orders to overturn a lot of what the Bush administration has done, but that's only in the realm of, from what I've read, domestic policy and not foreign policy. So I think what Obama and an Obama administration is going to do is they will definitely be able to make the American people happy with domestic policy changes. Foreign policy is definitely going to be, you know, as I've said, business as usual, but on a much more quieter playing field. I think that, for example, we have the EU talking about wanting to be an equal partner with the United States and creating a Bretton Woods II, you know, a second kind of Bretton Woods system in terms of a financial, a global financial system that has more regulation. I don't see the Obama administration agreeing to this. The Americans are not as happy with having the government regulating their banks as the Europeans are. So I mean, I don't think, despite Obama's overtures towards the EU and his discussions on reaching out to allies, he's not going to cede a lot of towards them. I mean, you know, it would never be in his best interest to anger the American people by giving too much to his allies. So in that sense, you know, foreign policy will definitely be more diplomatic than it will be militaristic. I mean, what you saw with the Bush administration was a conflation of national security with foreign policy. It sort of wasn't like national security became foreign policy. And so instead of the military being at the diplomacy service, the military did what it wanted to, and diplomacy definitely fell to the wayside and was overshadowed. With the Obama administration, you're going to see the scales tipped in favor of diplomacy, with the military used to support diplomacy. But I mean, nothing's really going to be all that different. As I've said, with the Middle East, the United States definitely wants to contain Iran and Syria with regards to their influence in Iraq. They still want to have some say in how Afghanistan rebuilds itself, which means that while Saudi Arabia and Pakistan would play a role in the possible diplomacy and talks with the Taliban, the U.S. wants to ensure that its interests are protected. And so it would mean, once again, not allowing an Iranian influence in the region. With Russia, I think that there will be a lot of diplomacy and discussions with Russia. As I've mentioned already, that they were trying to placate, at least under the Bush administration, placate the Russians with this new missile defense system. I don't know if Obama is necessarily going to scrap that or not. So as well, Latin America, there's a lot to be done there with regards to the anti-American sentiment that's been on the rise due to Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, as well as, you know, whether or not you're going to continue with embargoes in Cuba. So I think that for Obama, it's going to be a matter of dealing not with an overarching strategy that the Bush administration had and with regards to the war on terror, but maybe regional strategies that deal with, you know, okay, we'll deal with the Russians here. Then we're going to deal with Venezuela or deal with our Colombia, for example, being one of the few countries that is pro-American, sort of dealing with each situation on the ground. So in that sense, I think people are going to have to wait a long time before, if they do, see any discernible changes. But American influence will still be there. It's going to be quieter, but it's still going to be there. Sort of one of those instances where, you know, the big stick policy that Roosevelt had with Latin America. There was no jingoistic, brash, you know, loud military policy, but it was a kind of quiet, quiet foreign policy that still exerted U.S. influence in the region. So, and I think not FDR, just to clarify, which Roosevelt I meant, not Franklin Roosevelt, but Theodore Roosevelt. Anyways, having said that, I think that for Obama, it's going to be a much quieter approach to foreign policy, not a less jingoistic, but it's still going to be, you know, business as usual in that sense.
All right. Well, finally, let's turn to another extremely thorny international area right now, which is the U.S. Missile interceptors that are going up in Poland with the Czech radar systems as well. I understand there's some new developments coming online with this Polish missile interception. Can you tell us about those latest developments?
Right. Well, basically, as I mentioned briefly earlier, was that the U.S. wanted to establish this missile defense system within Czech Republic and Poland in order to intercept any missiles from rogue states like North Korea or Iran. However, these countries like Iran and North Korea, their missiles are short range and would come nowhere within the region that the U.S. wants to establish this missile defense system. So the Russians are saying this missile defense system is obviously not to counter any rogue state's missiles, but to inhibit ours. And so they've definitely been against this. Now, what has happened is that the United States has angered the Russians to the point where the Russians said, we're going to respond regardless, whether it's diplomatically, militarily, economically, there will be a response. And it finally came up with the Russians deciding to establish its own missile defense system. And they would set up these Iskander missiles around Kaliningrad, which is near Poland on the EU border. And it would intercept these missiles from the U.S. missile system and, in fact, nullifying its capabilities. And so what we have is a situation now where the United States has Russia establishing its own missile system in response to their proposed missile system. And it's sort of mirroring, you know, the Cold War all over again. And so just recently, the United States, they sent a diplomat, I think it was John Rood, or Rood, I can't remember, but they sent him to talk to the Russians and provide them with some new proposals and allow them access to these missile sites in Poland and the Czech Republic. But the Russians have not responded. And they actually, when the U.S. presented these proposals, it was before the Russians said they were going to set up a missile system. So what happened was the U.S. knew the Russians were angry and they were grumbling about this system. They said, okay, we'll send you proposals in which among the proposals will allow you access to these missile defense sites that we have in the Czech Republic and in Poland. And then a few days later, and after Obama's election, they responded by saying, well, we're going to establish these missiles in Kaliningrad to intercept any missiles from the proposed U.S. missile defense system. So it seems that even with these proposals being given to them, the Russians aren't buying it. They're just not going to tolerate this. It's like, okay, you're building this missile in your country and you're saying we can go and see the site, but it doesn't change the fact that you're building a missile in our backyard, a missile defense system in our backyard, which would definitely be against our favor or against our interest. And so you have this escalation now in terms of these missile defense systems being built, and it's just sort of mirroring the Cold War. I mean, it's just, one can't help but think about that in terms of, I mean, it's not an arms race, a nuclear arms race, but it's sort of, I guess, a missile defense system race. I don't know what you call it, but it's tit for tat, definitely. And the Russians have also been threatening, diplomatically or economically or militarily, threatening any countries that have aligned themselves with the United States or are pro-U.S. We already mentioned the war in Georgia, but there have definitely been threats made to Poland and the Czech Republic that continuing with this defense system is not in the best interests of their national security. And so you have the situation where Russia is saying you have three choices. And I mean, you can continue to side with the United States, you can, you know, deal with us, or we can crush you if you decide not to make a choice. And if they made the first choice, which is siding with the U.S., they still get crushed anyways. So you have a situation where the Russians are beginning to present this stark reality to former Soviet countries that have become NATO members or want to become NATO members. And so that's why I mentioned earlier the Obama administration has to deal with this situation and shift the focus from the Middle East as well to dealing with Eastern Europe, because countries that may think about being pro-American in terms of policies like missile defense systems or trade agreements may hesitate and think twice and decide, well, I don't want to become, you know, another Georgia. So maybe I will deal with Russia. Or, you know, maybe it's in my best interest to have energy deals with Russia, because Russia's shown a propensity to cut off energy to European countries anytime there's a diplomatic issue. So Russia definitely is in a very powerful position to sort of place this kind of stark reality for their former Soviet bloc countries. And that's why the United States is going to have to, they can't do anything militarily. They just don't have the manpower and they don't have the money, and I don't think they have the desire. No one does, to have a war in Europe. But there's going to definitely be a lot of diplomacy, maybe back channel discussions of some sort. But this proposal definitely is not enough for the Russians. They just aren't willing to cede anything. And I think they're very committed to this idea of countering U.S. influence. And they're very committed to this idea of a multipolar international system, which means that the U.S. is going to face an increasingly resurgent Russia that wants to clip any kind of influence the United States may have, or any ability to influence the region that the United States may have. So all of this stems from this one issue, the missile defense system, and it just sort of lays out the ramifications and what's at stake in terms of geostrategically and politically based on this one issue. So it's very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Cold War comparisons are apt, and I guess it's not an exact analogy, but it does seem to be some type of Cuban missile crisis shaping up, except it's Cuban missile interceptor crisis shaping up in terms of the escalation. And I think the analogy, while it's not completely apt, at least gives some of the gravity of the situation of what's developing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is a very serious situation. I don't think people or the media is giving it a lot of weight right now, because they're still very giddy from the U.S. elections, and the Middle East and Afghanistan is really high on the list of things to get done, things to clean up. And everyone's talking about Obama and what he has to do differently, or the task that he faces ahead of him. But at the end of the day, that this situation with Russia is going to have to be faced sooner or later, because it's definitely going to just mushroom and spiral out of control if it's not dealt with sooner. So, I think it's something that the mainstream media hasn't really been paying a lot of attention to, but definitely going to come up in the next few months. It's going to have to be faced.
All right, Marsha Reed, excellent analysis, very thought-provoking as always. Let's talk a little bit about the website, geopoliticalmonitor.com. For listeners who are hearing about it for the first time, can you tell us a little bit about what they might expect to find when they visit that website?
Right. Well, geopoliticalmonitor.com is, I think, a really, really, really great service. We have a lot of open-source intelligence. We have analysis, we have backgrounders, we have forecasts, and we cover a lot of stories that the mainstream media doesn't cover because it's been overshadowed by, you know, bigger stories or so-called bigger stories. Or we cover stories that the mainstream media doesn't want to touch for various reasons pertaining to bias. But there's no bias involved in our site at all. Geopoliticalmonitor.com provides a lot of bias-free analysis and forecasting, and a lot of excellent articles that just present situations on the ground. And they just provide a nice alternative to, I guess, the mainstream reporting that you see on other websites and in other media. So I think it's something that would be very beneficial to people who may want to know what's going on in other areas of the world that aren't really covered, or they want to get a little more depth into a news story. They might feel like they may only scratch the surface, but we go beyond the surface and we get really to the meat of the topic. So I think that's geopoliticalmonitor.com is really excellent in terms of providing that kind of service for its readers.
It certainly is, and I can attest to that. Can you tell the listeners about subscribing to geopoliticalmonitor.com?
Right. People, if they want to come to the site, and I encourage them strongly to do so, you can subscribe monthly or yearly. I believe monthly it's only $6, and yearly it's $60, which I think is a really great price and for the value. And you get access to our situation reports and our backgrounders, and you also have access to audio for our forecast. So it's something I would highly recommend for people who want to supplement any news that they currently read, or they want to get an alternative view. Not alternative in that there's a bias, but just alternative in terms of the depth of coverage that we have. So it's something I would strongly recommend. Just come to our site, geopoliticalmonitor.com, and just check out the articles that we have. We have a lot of great writers. So it's something I think people should definitely do, is come to our site.
Absolutely. And I'd just like to remind my listeners that the listeners of the Corbett Report can receive a special discount on a yearly subscription to geopoliticalmonitor.com by simply entering J Corbett, J-C-O-R-B-E-T-T, in the coupon code when subscribing to the yearly subscription. Not only will you receive a hefty discount from the yearly subscription price, but you'll also help to fund the Corbett Report podcast. So please, I recommend my listeners check it out. Marcia Reed, thank you once again for your excellent analysis, and I look forward to hearing more of your analysis next month.
Thanks a lot. I'm glad to talk with you today.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks.